Do you know what all the current issues are with gun rights? Tune in next to find out on Principles and Policies. Hello, this is Chuck Michaelis. I'm the Executive Director of Camp American and the Vice Chairman of the Institute for Principled Policy. And this week, we're going to do a presentation. It's actually a follow-up to the 2 weeks while we were at camp. We ran some audios from Pastor David Whitney on the Second Amendment and the right to self-defense. Now we're going to talk about issues with your gun rights with Gun Owners of America CEO Larry Pratt. I'm not going to take up too much time because this is a very long presentation, and I think I'm just going to go right to it. It's pretty self-explanatory. Here's Larry Pratt with current issues with the Second Amendment.
You all, I think, many of you certainly, heard about the election that it was just this week still, right? In Virginia. Tuesday. Yeah, a Tuesday primary. A guy came from, for most people's account, that makes me feel better because I didn't think time had been going that fast. Tuesday a week, David Bratt, Dr. David Bratt, a college professor, head of the economics department at Randolph-Macon University College, very near Richmond, took on seven-term member of the House of Representatives and number two Republican in the power structure there, the majority leader. He defeated Eric Cantor. It certainly came as a surprise to Eric Cantor because he was in his office in Washington, not in his office, excuse me, at a very expensive restaurant having dinner with some lobbyists the night the election returns came in. And it probably didn't do his dessert any favors that the news was not looking good. It came as a surprise. He had been that out of touch that this campaign could be mounted. Almost no media advertisements, if any. I'm not sure that Bratt had the money for that. But what he did have money for was to have some volunteer coordinators and literature that was handed out. I'm not even sure if he did any mailings, but he did an actual grassroots campaign, door-to-door, identifying voters, and then getting them out to vote at election time. The reaction of the establishment has been to suggest that Bratt is a new four-letter word. It's just, they are beside themselves that this guy won. It's as if, how dare he do this against Eric Cantor, who was on his way to being speaker, don't you know? Well, they've begun labeling him all kinds of things, and it's a real stretch because he's a God-fearing man, well-spoken, kind of soft-spoken guy, clearly has strong opinions, but he doesn't speak like a wild man. It's just that the ideas of freedom and limited government that he supports terrorize the establishment. And I've come to believe that that's why they view us, generally speaking, those who support limited government, who support respecting the Constitution's limits on government, as terrorists, because that does terrorize them. Maybe not in the sense of we're coming with a machete to kill them with a machete, but it does terrorize them that the people they know, the perks that they enjoy, and the ones that are at the forefront of the liberal establishment enjoy lots of perks, and they're all paid for by you and me. Even those of you who may not have income in the sense of an office job or something, whatever money you're spending and those taxes on those purchases, that's going to support the liberal establishment. So we're all in this together. None of us are exempt from it. One of the more outrageous things they've done with this label of terrorist, of course, somebody like yourself, myself, would be included in that, sometimes specifically in lists that they have, infamously the Southern Poverty Law Center in Montgomery, Alabama. But one of the groups that they've taken to going after now is Oath Keepers. Now, Oath Keepers are made up of people who are currently or retired from police and fire department and military service. And the oath that they are talking about is the oath that they took when they were sworn in to their office to uphold and protect the Constitution. That's the sum and substance of what an Oath Keeper believes and supports, and why he is perhaps officially, maybe he's actually paid a membership fee to join the Oath Keepers. And it is open to other people who support that concept, even if they haven't had a time of service. And those are the ones that are being labeled as potential terrorists. Some of the same people that call them potential terrorists have labeled the American Family Association a hate group. Now, the American Family Association is about the most unlikely suspect. They have a chain of radio stations around the country. They play contemporary Christian music. They have sermons. They have lectures. They might even, from time to time, have a debate or two. And that's it. I've listened to it, and it's not high octane. It's very matter of fact, and yet to call them a hate group tells me that, again, they're terrorized by the thought that somebody would advocate that the family is defined in Scripture as a man and a woman, and that killing little babies is not viewed well by God. And for that, they are labeled hate group. Oh, also that they insist that marriage be just man and woman, and not some other invention that really isn't marriage, and we shouldn't adorn that sort of activity with the term marriage, because marriage inherently is a man and a woman. We see that from the very beginning of Scripture. The Department of Defense has a training manual, and it says that those supporting individual liberty, you got to watch out because those are extremists. Well, again, if your mindset is that the government and your buddies in government are there to tell us what to do and for us to suggest that that's not the way it's supposed to be, that that's not what the Constitution authorizes, well, then that's very hateful. That's such an extreme notion. And in their mind, it is. Now, I think they also know that they're playing with words, because they have dealt with us, they've seen us on television, and they know that those kinds of labels are just that. They're labels designed to shape the debate, and since they can't win by force of argument or with the facts, then they resort to name-calling. There's an old adage from law schools that supposedly lawyers were taught that if you don't have the facts on your side in the case, like your client is guilty, and you don't have the law on your side, like the law is against murder, then argue against the other guy. Argue against the prosecution. Argue against the victim himself. It was his fault. He had it coming, blah, blah, blah. And that may actually be taught unofficially in some law schools. I wouldn't know, but that's certainly attributed to the training that attorneys get, and I've not heard too many of them disavow it, so there may be something to it. But anyway, that's not just limited to attorneys. I've been in so many situations where I've been in debate, and typically with a TV anchor or an opponent that they like to have us. We always have to have somebody opposed to us, whereas if you look at MSNBC or CNN, they don't usually, not always, but usually they don't have an opposing point of view for an immediate rebuttal in a debate format. They don't like, they like to shield their folks from iron sharpening iron, and they like to have them just be able to say whatever they want, invent stuff. It is amazing the kind of statements that can be made by people on the left out of whole cloth. One of the new groups, the Bloomberg Group, I can't remember the gal's name who's heading it up, but, you know, Mothers Against Gun Violence or something of that sort. And she said, well, there just are no cases of people using guns in self-defense.
Earth to Lady Earth.
It's an official statistic gathered by the CDC and the FBI every year, how many people use firearms in self-defense. And it's several times a day, not always firing the gun, but they definitely are used, and certainly by people my age or a woman or a small guy. A lot of people really don't have any alternative but something of that sort. And she makes this statement. I guess she was assuming that she could say anything she wanted, since that sounded like such a powerful point, and not expecting to be rebutted so quickly. I mean, even people on her own side would have to kind of have thought, oh, why did she say that? You know, so, but that's good. I like them doing things like that, because it shows they were willing to take to the extreme their own position, and they really don't, at that extreme, they don't believe in self-defense. And I've actually gotten some of them in our little debates on television to admit that they don't believe in self-defense. Just don't. And one time they were pushed to the point, well, so if you're watching your wife and children be murdered in your house and you have a gun that you could use to stop it, you wouldn't use the gun? No. That is so offensive to God. They think they're being so pure in their do no harm. Well, they are doing harm. If they're willing to say that they would allow the murder to happen in front of them when they had the means to stop it, they're actually making themselves participants in the murder by not stopping it. Oh, back to the discussion of terrorists. Janet Napolitano also had labeled returning vets as potential terror danger and had circulated a memo to that effect to the police agencies of the country. Now, you think about that. Some of these police officers identify themselves as law enforcement, as I was describing earlier. They work for the government. They're there to tell us to do what the government says. And when they're told that a returning vet is a guy that might be a terrorist or could become a terrorist, that idea is going to have consequences, and it's not going to end well when they talk like that, with official sanction from the federal government at the highest levels. You know, there was an event that occurred last year that really lays out how, what are the dynamics of lobbying and pressures that make things happen in the political and legislative arena. After Newtown, there was a bill that was put into the Congress by Senators Toomey and Manchin that would have expanded the current requirement that a background check be done on a gun when you buy it at a store to all private transactions. You'd have to take you and the buyer seller to the store and put it on paper there in the store. Well, background checks is not a crime-fighting tool. It's a tool for registering guns. The last year of record, there were some 11 million background checks done, people buying a gun at a store. And of that, I forget, there were a few thousand that were slowed up to have further check, and might have turned out that there's another Lawrence D. Pratt that lives in Ohio somewhere, and he's got a record. And so they flag it, and they do more intensive background and find out that the Larry Pratt that's buying the gun in Springfield, Virginia, is not the guy that's of interest in Ohio. There are a few of those that happen, but again, they're not catching a criminal buying a gun. What they do come up with at the end of the day is some 40 prosecutions of people that under the law were not allowed to buy a gun because of some kind of criminal past, and 14 prosecutions out of some 11 million people going out to buy a gun. Now, how anybody can argue that's a law enforcement tool is beyond me. And the millions of dollars that we spend, the personnel that are involved in that, the computer banks that are involved in that, for 14 prosecutions. And that doesn't say they all got convicted either. I don't have that figure. I don't know. Although at the federal level, it's probably pretty high because you have fewer rights in court at the federal level and there's more likelihood of getting convicted. So anyway, this was the issue. And they wanted to expand it to all private sales. Now, since it's not a crime-fighting tool, why would they want to do that? Well, after the NSA scandal, which showed that the government was violating federal law by listening to all of our conversations, every telephone call. So, you know, hi, Mom, they start recording. And totally illegally. You're supposed to be a person of interest, somebody that's suspected of being connected to a terrorist abroad before they can do that. And I narrowed the field pretty well. And they don't care. So they had just indiscriminately listened to everybody's conversation. Hi, big brother. That's what we're talking about. And the and all for what? Well, I'm quite convinced that they have a compulsion to have lists so that they can use them at their pleasure in the future. And why would you want a list of gun owners in the country? Well, it wouldn't be important to you if you thought they were on your side. But if you've called them the enemy, if you've called them potential terrorists, which they have, then, yeah, they might want to know who we are and where we are so that at some point, if they think it's necessary, forget the Second Amendment, they could go and confiscate guns. That's the pure and simple truth of what the instant background check is all about. They would deny it. It's against the law. But then they broke the law with the NSA scandal and with the IRS scandal, where they used the IRS to go after political opponents of the president by hammering down on their tax issues. So the idea that there would be a benign use of them knowing that I have XYZ guns is not very comforting. It's not very plausible. So happily, Senator Cruz, who hadn't been in the Congress for even a year, I think this first meeting was in the end of July, maybe, in Senator Lee's office. Senator Lee convened a meeting of a few other senators, like Senator Cruz, who was the only other senator that actually stayed for the whole meeting. There were two or three others that kind of made cameo appearances in and out. But those two were there to do business. And then they had invited a number of groups, the heads of groups, that had opposed Obamacare up to that point. Well, Gun Owners of America had opposed Obamacare for a simple reason. It, among the many tentacles that it extends into our society, is that it's a gun control measure. Because it says all our medical records, but all, are open to the feds. Now, a lot of people have been to see a psychiatrist or a psychologist, and they might have, from the psychiatrist, gotten a prescription for a pill for a mild depression or something like that. And that's making them vulnerable now. In New York State, where they have a comparable situation to the federal I'm describing, about 2 or 3 months ago, just as the implementation of their new anti-gun law started to hammer down, I read of one case where a guy, a gun owner, 25 years before had been prescribed one of these mild antidepressants for a mild depression. They came and used that as a predicate to confiscate his guns. No allegation that he's a danger to anybody or himself, but it was the predicate for grabbing the guns. And this is, of course, New York State, where they have a virulently anti-Second Amendment governor. This is the kind of thing that we're fighting at the federal level. And at the meeting, we were formulating a strategy on how the different groups would try to comport themselves during the time between then and the vote, which occurred beginning of October that year. And the agreement was that we would communicate to our membership, just without variation, that the issue is to kill Obamacare, defund Obamacare, don't let it go into operation. And because whatever, I mean, different groups had different particular interests, but all their particular interests were negatively impacted by Obamacare. It's a humongous piece of cancer that is throughout the body politic. So a lot of variety of groups there. And the thing that stuck in my mind that I took away from that meeting the most, first of all, that Senator Lee had convened it, and secondly, during the course of the discussion, Senator Cruz said, I don't know whether we're going to win this fight or not, but I do know that we have to make this fight. Now, to hear a politician say that we may charge up the hill and get mowed down, I can't think of when I last heard a politician say that. A typical response would be you go to see a legislator and you have an idea and you present it to him and he says, well, that's really a good idea. I agree with you. Can you show me how I'm going to win? And if you can't show him how you're going to win, he'll back off, but not Senator Cruz. If he thinks that that's an important issue and the fight needs to be fought, he'll mount up and charge and not turn back. And that's something I think is an admirable characteristic. And I've been watching him since he got into the Congress. And even though he has no position of official leadership, he's actually a leader. And he has changed the dialogue to a considerable extent within the Senate. And his famous talkathon that was nearly 24 hours was one of the ways that he accomplished that. And he's forced votes on issues that the established politicians of both parties would rather there not be a vote, because then it puts them on a public record for voting for or against some perhaps controversial measure. And they don't like that. And so when he was willing to let Obama shut down the government because he was trying to keep the budget from being renewed unless there was a continuation of the debt limit. And Obama said, well, I'm not going to do that. I want to keep spending, so I'll shut the government down. And he did. And the media tried to say that it was Cruz that had shut the government down. No. Cruz was every day saying, I want the government to continue in operation. I don't want people to be furloughed. I just want us to live within our limit. We cannot continue to, every time we get to this point, increase the debt limit again. Well, he lost the immediate effort, but frankly, what I think he did was to win the debate on Obamacare. For one thing, the American people hadn't really focused in on Obamacare because the media hadn't focused in on Obamacare. But when Ted Cruz is there in the Senate all night, I tuned in at 8 in the morning, he was still on message. It was an incredible opportunity that he took to educate people no matter when they looked at what he was doing, except for the bedtime story that he read to his daughters. Everything he was saying was on message about zero care, I prefer to call it, than Obamacare, because there are a lot of people that are not going to be getting care, period. So that was a remarkable event, and I think it established Senator Cruz and his good friend, Senator Mike Lee of Utah, as real leaders in the United States Senate. And I think they've accomplished a great deal to shift public debate. They lost a vote and they still won on the larger issue, is my point. And that is leadership, not having the title of majority leader or something like that. Generally, the official leaders are actually quite timid and are willing to compromise with the other party. And that was why I think Eric Cantor got a pink slip last Tuesday, because the voters became increasingly aware that he was part of the problem, that he would always accede to the demands for more, 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 more. Feed me, feed me, feed me. And there was never any organized resistance by a Republican leader who was specifically tasked with developing the issues that the Republicans would be willing to fight on. He just wasn't doing that. So that, I think, was somewhat eye-opening to the establishment, that the natives are restless, that we're tired of business as usual, that we don't want the government to continue to grow without being checked, that we do want accountability, and for somebody to come and tell us that he knows best and just let him take care of everything, that apparently may not be an effective argument anymore. And I'm very happy that that we've seen this come up. It was stunning. By the way, there's something that's being done to the veterans. I mentioned it before, but I want to give you a number. The well before zero care, Republican and Democrat administrations alike were allowing the ATF and the Justice Department to use a medical diagnosis of veterans as a reason for disarming them. And back in 2008, when we fought this fight under President Bush, we had calls from our members saying that they had gotten the knock on the door because their veterans' medical records had been put into the system and names matched, oh, guy with a psychiatric disorder, gun owner. Now, that's if there ever were a reason to not want them to have access to lists of gun owners, that's it. But obviously, in spite of the prohibition under federal law for having a list of gun owners, the only way they can really get it is from the instant background check, which prohibits them by law from keeping those names for more than 24 hours. And obviously, they're keeping the names forever. You give the government some information about yourself, or they take it from you, it's not ever going to go away. It was interesting, by the way, at that meeting, to backtrack, in Senator Lee's office, there were only groups that had already been opposing zero care and relating it to their members as to why they were doing it. The NRA was not at that meeting. They have yet to see the connect between information gathering, the government having all that information, and to see what a threat it would be. In fact, the instant background check was their invention. Way back, 25 years or so ago, when the instant background check came on the books, NRA had been opposed to the waiting period, which was then the big anti-gun issue, and they wanted people to wait 5 days before they could buy the gun and then take delivery of the gun. And I went over and I talked to the then head of the NRA, and I said, look, both proposals are unconstitutional, but one is benign and the other is poison. I said, if they make us wait 5 days, there may be people that die in that period because they couldn't get a gun, and we had evidences of that, particularly women in an abusive situation. But the danger of the government having the name of all gun owners is enormously beyond those few individuals that might be in peril. And I said, there will be mission growth, which we're talking about right now, right? The psychiatric disorders now being put in, not people that are dangerous. Just because somebody's been to see a psychiatrist doesn't mean he's dangerous. That's just simply not the case. And most of it's treated medically, and talk to a psychiatrist and they'll say they have a good track record. Most of the time, people respond well. There's always outlying cases, they'll say, but to put the burden on somebody with one of those diagnoses is just unjust and has not been adjudicated in a court of law. Due process was not followed, is not followed when the guns are taken from people that do have a psychiatric record. And that's really a very sad thing. I don't have an explanation for what happened with Senator Toomey. As a member of the House of Representatives, he was a good vote on Second Amendment issues. And so when he ran for the Senate against Arlen Specter, who was one of our nightmares, we had no problem in seeing Representative Pat Toomey against Arlen Specter for the United States Senate. He was successful. We were delighted. And taking on Arlen Specter meant that he was taking on the establishment. And that has been one of our litmus tests for who we want to support. Are they willing? Have they been willing in the past to take on somebody of the same party, maybe a prominent person of their same party? Because if they're willing to do that, then they're not likely to sort of fold and play ball in order to go along to get along in the body that they're seeking election to. So we thought that Toomey passed on all counts. Well, he's the one exception to our rule, which I think is a pretty good one. We'll really support somebody in a kind of maximum way for us if we've seen not only a good record, but action that shows that the person is willing to take on the establishment. Because that's what they're there for. They're there just to occupy a seat. They may vote well, and we love you, thank you very much, but we're not going to, you know, put in a maximum effort. We don't have the kind of resources to allow that. When we go all out, it has to be for a Ted Cruz. We saw him coming, and we went all out in his primary when he defeated a statewide office holder, and then in the general election. And we had somebody down in the state almost every weekend doing things for Ted Cruz's campaign, and we couldn't possibly do that for many people. But we saw something in Ted Cruz, and frankly, if you've ever get a chance to meet his dad, you'll see that the apple rolled not one inch from the tree when it fell. I had a chance to meet his father at a conference, an all-day conference in a church on a Sunday, and it's clear that Senator Cruz is simply Ted Cruz without the Cuban accent. They are just absolutely peas in a pod. And Ted Cruz, Rafael Cruz, really did a great job, and his wife, in bringing up Ted Cruz, because you can see where that rudder came from. It was a transplant right from mom and dad. So we're very delighted that we have somebody like that come on the scene, and I think it's going to encourage others to do the same, even as we hope that the defeat of Cantor will re-energize those that might be running against either incumbents or establishment-backed candidates, that it is possible to make these changes. And this is probably a year when it can be done, because I think there are a number of good candidates running this year that might not have run had their perception been that this was not going to be a good year. There seems to be a correlation. We've known for a year out that this was likely to be a good year for a conservative and a Republican to run. And that's enough time for people to make decisions to run, talk to friends, see if they can get a campaign together, get their candidacy filed, and have something going in time to be able to engage the incumbent. And we've seen some of that. So I think, Lord willing, we're going to see some more events such as we saw in the 7th District of Virginia. We're going to see, hopefully, a few more incumbents go down, and certainly in open seats, the constitutionally oriented candidate prevail. I think the Bundy Ranch was an episode that might have been a pivotal moment in American history, even as the Battle of Lexington was. Bunker Hill wasn't quite as significant as Lexington, but it alliterates better for a bumper sticker. From Bunker Hill to Bunkerville, because the ranch that Mr. Bundy has is outside of the little town of Bunkerville, Nevada. And on that ranch, as some of you may well know, he was assaulted by 200 agents of the Bureau of Land Management. They didn't like him running his cattle on land, some of which was public, that his family had been using since the 1880s, before there was an unconstitutional national forest system, before there was the idea of huge tracts of land being owned and controlled by the federal government, because the Constitution only provides for that amount of land being needed for the operation of the federal government and no more. It's very specific. If you look at Article 1, Section 8, one of the paragraphs lists what the government is able to own, federal government. And Bundy was under increasing pressure to stay off that land. Well, from what I can tell in pictures, that land looks a lot like the land that I saw in Israel. And their idea of a pasture in Israel is my idea of a desert here. And you see a little blade of grass, and only a sheep could exist on it. So I guess it's a little bit more friendly out in Nevada than it is even in Israel, because running cattle is more water intensive. Maybe Bundy has lots of tanks that he uses. That could be the case as well, and because the land looks an awful lot like Israel. It's just that anybody can subsist in that is a tribute to human grit and ingenuity. Well, Bundy, I think, had a lot of conservatives divided, because the idea of standing up to the federal government with a gun is something that it's a little hard to contemplate for a lot of people. And yet that's exactly what happened, if you will, at Bunker Hill, well before Bunkerville. Even among many conservatives, I think the idea is that if the federal government says something, then at most we should just argue in court, but we shouldn't do anything else. Well, Bundy was ignoring them. He was ignoring their orders because, in his view, and I think he's right, the orders had no legitimacy. His family had a prior right to the invasion by the federal government in the last century to claim those lands as belonging to the federal government. And so the standoff, as you know, lasted for, about a month, I guess it was. And the thing that so encouraged me was that people came from all over the country to defend Clive and Bundy and his ranch and to keep the feds from killing his livestock. And by the way, when the feds stood down and they were able to go into the areas that the feds had encamped, they found that when they the cattle had been penned up. Now, some might have thought, well, they were just going to release them for sale or something like that. No, they found big pits that had been dug out, and that's where the cattle were going to be killed and covered over. So they weren't going to sell his cattle to satisfy a debt that they claimed that he owed by not paying fees. They were going in there maliciously to wipe him out as a rancher. The cattle alone, the 300 or so head, I understand, would have been about $1 million. Altogether, his herd was in the neighborhood of $3 million, and they evidently wanted to at least do away with $1 million worth of that herd. It could well have forced him into bankruptcy. Well, the thing that I recently verified, we don't hear anything about it, but after the government stood down and after they went away, and everybody that I talked to kind of assumes that they're looking for an opportunity and they'll be back, and because of that perception, there are at any one time a number of volunteers from around the country still on the Bundy Ranch acting as a tripwire so that if the feds were to come back, they could be engaged and then the country could reassert itself and reappear to the defense of Bundy on his ranch. Now that makes me really happy to call myself an American, that we have people in this country who are willing to do that. And they were coming from all over the country, from New England, from everywhere, not just neighboring states, not just Nevada. So this was a demonstration that maybe there's still some pulse in our national veins. And it was a very encouraging thing to learn about. And maybe lastly, I would suggest that there's something else going on. We're not in Elkhart County, are we?
No.
Okay. Nearby?
We would have passed through it. We would have been on the right road.
Well, I'm very sorry, because one of our members is the sheriff there. Life member Brad Rogers is a sheriff that understands and has acted on the doctrine of the sheriff being the highest law enforcement officer in his county. And Rogers was approached about 2.5 years ago by a farmer who produces raw milk. And the feds have an intense dislike of raw milk. They can't point to it being a problem, but they can't list all the people that have gotten sick and or died from it, but they just know it's wrong. I mean, it can't be safe unless it's been pasteurized. And they ignore the number of people that have had trouble with pasteurized milk. So they had been, the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, had been harassing this farmer with repeated inspections. And it got to the point that he saw them about ready to take him into federal court, which is not a good place for a citizen to be. I've mentioned earlier that your rights are pretty well frazzled in that venue, and you're not able to mount as effective in a defense as you would like. And so he went to the sheriff and said, "This is what's going on. I really think I need your help." And the sheriff went out. He did his due diligence to look over the farm. The farm was fine. And so he went back and wrote an email to the head attorney at the Food and Drug Administration and said, "If you all put another foot on this farmer's property, I'm arresting you." And she wrote back and said, "Well, if you do that, we'll arrest you." And his response to that was, "Game on." That was 2.5 years ago, and that's obviously been sufficient for the feds to stay away. The sheriff has effectively interposed himself and his office between that farmer and arguably others in the county that are in the same situation as the farmer and the federal government. And there are sheriffs in other counties around the country where it may involve citizens going into a national forest and taking out deadwood. And because the government doesn't view that as natural, that reduces the likelihood of a forest fire reaching a maximum intensity. You're artificially interfering with nature, they argue, by taking out this kindling, if you will, for a potential fire. They have had confrontations over that. I met a sheriff in New Mexico on the Mexican border in the mountains who had a very similar situation to the sheriff of Elkhart County. That if you try to arrest the people in my county that are out cutting deadwood in the national forest, I'll arrest you. And that blocked the federal government there. And Josephine County, Oregon, same scenario I can't remember the county in California, but there's also one in Nevada where the feds have threatened to rustle cattle, to steal people's cattle because they're using a water hole that's on, quote, federal land. And they have these folks that are running their cattle there have a generational long written contractual agreement with the federal government that they have a property right in that water hole. You and I might not be able to come in from out of state and water some cattle there, but some of those farmers, those ranchers in that area, do have actual contractual use of that facility. So the feds are changing the rules. They're acting just as if they were kings, and well, that was then and this is now. And in this one situation in Nevada, in Nye County, the confrontation over the watering holes, on a couple of nights, the feds had come out and stolen some of this farmer's cattle. So the sheriff of the county and I presume the rancher and maybe some of his men and certainly sheriff's deputies went out to the site, and I don't know how many nights they had to be there, but lo and behold, a third trip all of a sudden came lumbering their way through the night, and as the feds got out and prepared to rustle some more cattle, the ranchers and the deputies told them to stand down, and the feds pointed their guns at the people, and it was a very tense moment, and finally the feds stood down and left. But that's, again, something that a sheriff can do to protect his people in his county. And that is something that he really is supposed to do. Now, it's not always against the federal government. It could be just some John Dillon bank robber. But the fact of the matter is the sheriff is there to protect, and that very well may, in our environment, in our day, mean protect from the federales. So that's actually a very good development, that these sheriffs are popping up. Some 400 of them out of maybe 3,000 sheriffs in our country have publicly stated that they will, at a minimum, not cooperate with an unconstitutional federal raid. Well, that may sound wimpy until you realize that, happily, the feds don't have that many boots on the ground. And if they can't get the support from the locals, then they usually just don't go through with it. So there doesn't have to be a standoff. The sheriff doesn't even have to be willing to do a standoff. But if he's willing to say to his buddies that he probably has worked with for years in the federal government, I will not cooperate if you're doing something that's not constitutional, then that typically puts a lid on those kinds of activities, be it a raid on a gun owner, be it an arrest of somebody in a forest or running cattle or mining. There's any number of activities that are profitable that people do to make a living that are the target of what the federal government doesn't like, even though it's those activities that pay for the salaries of those in the federal government. Pretty counterproductive way of thinking, it seems to me. But anyway, we, I think, have maybe we'll look back and be able to say what happened at the Bundy Ranch was a turning point in modern American history in the 21st century. Maybe the election of Dr. David Brat beating longtime incumbent Eric Cantor in the Republican hierarchy was a turning point. We'll see. But these were very exciting moments, and a lot of the people in the establishment had no idea that something like this could happen. The idea of having guns and using them as the Second Amendment envisaged, using them to resist tyranny. In the specific case of Mr. Bundy's ranch, the tyranny of the Bureau of Land Management and trying to kill his cattle. That's tyranny. And guns were used so far peacefully by the people to stop it. Now, I'm told by former Sheriff Richard Mack that it almost wasn't peaceful on the Bundy Ranch. Unarmed cowboys and some cowgirls were mounted on horses, and they were riding through armed BLM agents who had their guns pointed at them to go and unlock the corral and let the cattle out that they had stolen from Bundy that they were going to kill. And it looked as if, and the cowboys believed that some of us are going to get shot. These guys are looking for blood. And finally, a sheriff's deputy, rather belatedly but happily better late than never, rode up to one of the BLM agents and said, "Do you want to be known as the people that shot down unarmed men and women?" And that broke them. It was that very key question that they finally backed off. At least not that night did they want to be known as those kind of people. So we've come very close to having violence in this resistance to federal tyranny. But the fact that we have guns and have shown a willingness to use them seems to me to indicate that the Second Amendment, in spite of the terrible things that have been done to it over the many decades in the last century, still is alive and well. And there still are people that understand what it's all about to restrain tyranny and are willing to use it for just that purpose. So a lot of bad things going on, and we could all sit around and make a long list and talk about it and probably be all right, all true. But at the end of the day, we're not finished yet. If there are any questions, I guess.
Yeah, I guess about gun registration. You said that the government's not supposed to keep those information, because I work in law enforcement, and I know if you get a gun, the BCI, which is like the Ohio FBI, will tell us who the owner of that gun, who bought the gun, and then we trace it backwards to find out, you know, who last had the gun before the murder was committed or whatever crime was.
That's a registration list of people that have bought a gun, and the fact of the matter is that federal law says the information on the owner and the type of firearm is to be kept for only 24 hours. But hey, you know, what's a law among consenting adults?
So that ability should not exist, basically.
Correct.
Because according Correct. To okay, that's what I'm asking.
And since the background check, as I argued earlier, is pointless, then it raises the question, why are we spending all that money on it? Well, I think to ask the question answers it. It's a deadly list that could be used against us at such time as they decide to move.
Larry, real quickly, David Bratt's win in Virginia was totally unexpected and I think caught the establishment very flat-footed.
Not totally. We finally caught on, and on the last day, we had robocalls encouraging Republican voters to go to the polls because we knew that a great majority of them would vote right, so we just indiscriminately got in there.
And that's good because you guys you use some good tactics. The question is now, how repeatable is that? Because the establishment is now aware of that they're not invulnerable when they're in the high positions. And how much more effort is it going to take, or strategic planning, or changing the strategies it's going to take in order to try to seal some more victories in November or in future primaries?
It was a wake-up call for them. I think you're quite right. However, it was also an energizing moment for folks on our side. You mean we really can take down an Eric Cantor? That's, I never would have thought. And the way it was done was a grassroots campaign. They ID'd the voters. You could go right back to Abraham Lincoln, the way you win an election, identify your voters and get them out to vote on election day. And that is precisely what David Bratt did. Eric Cantor, in contrast, had no ground game that I've just described. He spent, I think I've heard, $1 million on radio TV ads. And I think we can conclude from that is that ads are heard, voters vote. And ads may not even be heard because the only time I'm listening to the radio is probably something like a Rush Limbaugh when I'm at the office, and it's kind of like background. And I certainly don't even know what ads are on because that's usually when I go to the bathroom.
I have kind of a different type of a question, but you speak very highly of Ted Cruz, and I think that everybody sitting in this room has a lot of high hopes.
Right.
For Ted Cruz, but that's an awful lot of pressure on one man. And he's middle-aged. Do you think he can handle the pressure? How long do you think he has to handle the pressure? And who else is there to really, really support him? I know Mike Lee, but the other ones all seem to have, I mean, it just doesn't seem like there's much other support.
Well,
so how much can one man take with this whole...
I was very encouraged by what we saw in that showdown. With the when Obama was willing to shut down some of the government in order to try to break Cruz's back. And he knew that Obama might try to do that, and he knew that Obama would try to blame him as if shutting down the government is such a terrible thing. It was shut down. I didn't know that. Didn't get the memo. Because unless you're a veteran or somebody like that that might have a legitimate call on an obligation by the government. The rest of what the government does, by and large, is really outside anything that you and I would be interested in having the government do, and probably aren't a recipient of it unless we're a target of it. So I'm sure, for instance, some of our tax money has put all of us in one capacity or another in the IRS database. But I think Cruz has apparently such a strong Christian commitment that it would seem, especially after that one night stand, that he doesn't really much care what the media says, what John McCain says. He broke John McCain. Now he didn't turn him around. McCain hasn't repented, but McCain, as you may remember, when Cruz broke out his effort, I think it was October 1, to defund implementation of Zero Care, McCain called him a wacko bird. After the first 2 weeks of the rollout, when it became obvious how devastating and destructive zero care is, I've not heard McCain use that word ever again. So he's probably of the same cranky opinion, but he's certainly learned to express himself better. And I think Cruz showed that he can handle himself riding solo with his sidekick, Mike Lee. They both are apparently extremely intelligent and extremely committed. And two guys of that sort in a body of mostly wusses is probably enough to do very well. Thank you very much. So far, so good.
Really heard of a, other than, you know, getting a decision from a judge or some kind of something like that, a way to take somebody's guns rights away. I mean, or if they get a felony that takes their gun rights away. So could you elaborate on what the process the government would use to take somebody's guns away? Would it be a medical or?
Usually it's an opportunistic event where somebody goes into get medical service, and if they see a psychiatrist, that goes on their record. And then at such time as they ever cross-match databases, which they did in New York, then that makes it real easy to know who it is that they want to go after. Happily, in other states, it's not quite so systematic, although it's somewhat like that in California. We've seen similar accounts coming out of California. The good news is that even in New York, a whole bunch of sheriffs said, I'm not enforcing this. I'm not going after anybody's guns. And in Colorado, all but two of the sheriffs, 52 out of 54 maybe, said, I'm not going after anybody's guns. This law stinks. They've actually denounced the law. And in fact, the law is so bad that the governor, who was so happy to sign it without having read it, he just knew it was good. He's now backing off. And well, it was my aides that told me to vote for it. I hadn't read it. I was just given bad advice. Boy, that's a real sign up for leadership, isn't it? So, ain't nobody here but us chickens now, buddy. I'll tell you what. So they're starting to fall apart when people see what it was really all about. And when many people in the police community are saying, I'm not enforcing that. Even in New York, well, that's pretty stunning. And in Connecticut, some 300,000 people that failed to re-register guns that were already registered. So we know who they are, pretty much. And not a finger has been lifted to go get them either. You really want to try to disarm an army of 300,000? And I don't think that a lot of the law enforcement there agree with that. They don't support it. In fact, some of them have said so in social media. Some, last I saw, 250. They don't have sheriffs. They voted them away. That was unfortunate. But a lot of those police officers and chiefs are saying, not here. So it's I would say it's a situation that's far from totally against us. In fact, if anything, they may have overreached. And it may be that, from what I've been reading, particularly in Colorado, the Democrats may be riding into a tempest that's going to capsize their little boats. So we'll see.
Okay.
He just said something that I thought maybe you might want to elaborate on. You just said that some states voted out their sheriffs.
Connecticut actually had a referendum, and they voted to do away with the office of sheriff.
And I didn't know if the kids knew that, so I thought maybe you might want to elaborate that.
And in New Jersey, they've de facto done the same thing by giving them very few funds so that they've just become kind of a shell. They've taken away a lot of their arrest powers. They've basically become people who serve complaints to citizens about civil court cases, and I believe they still have them maintain the jails. But that's about it. The idea that they have actual police powers has been taken away.
But they still, well, could they still then turn the feds away as the sheriff capacity they are now?
I would think they would need a pretty good militia to do it. Yeah. They couldn't do it just in their office of sheriff because they wouldn't have the means to do it.
Right.
So, yeah.
In some place, I don't know, in Indianapolis, they got something down there called
Unigo. Oh, yeah. Yeah, right. And that was a de facto way of zapping the office of sheriff there as well. So yeah, it was very imaginative. It happened under former Senator Lugar when he was the mayor of Indianapolis. I lived there at the time. I saw that happen. So that was a long time ago for those of you who never heard of any of the people we're talking about.
I lived there under HUD, not...
Oh, yeah.
So, okay, unfortunately, we're out of time. Give Larry a great big hand, if you would.
Thank you, guys.
And I assume you'll be around to answer some questions for a while. We have questions afterwards.
That was Larry Pratt from Gun Owners of America. That was a presentation given at Camp American in June of 2014. If you want more information on that presentation or on Gun Owners of America or on Camp American or on the Institute for Principled Policy, You can go to www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com, or www.campamerican.com. That's campamerican.com. And be sure to join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.